This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nick Hornby, is best known for his novel High Fidelity, about a guy who owns a record store and is obsessed with pop music. High Fidelity and Hornby's books Fever Pitch and About a Boy were adapted into films. Hornby returns to the world of music obsession in his new novel, Juliet Naked. The novel starts with a British couple, Duncan and Annie, making a pilgrimage to America that includes a stop in Minneapolis at perhaps the most important toilet in musical history, the toilet where singer, songwriter, and guitarist Tucker Crowe apparently had a life-changing experience in the middle of a set. When he walked out of that men's room, he gave up recording and performing. That was in 1986. Duncan has since become an expert on Crowe's music and runs a website devoted to every known detail of Crowe's life and work. There's big news in Duncan's world when Crowe releases a collection of the demos from his most famous album. Annie posts a negative review on Duncan's site. Crowe responds to it. Annie and Crowe meet, and a weird triangle is formed. Nick Hornby, welcome back to Fresh Air. I really enjoyed your novel. In fact, I'd like you to start with a reading from it. And this is from early on when Annie is describing how the internet has changed her boyfriend Duncan's relationship with Tucker Crowe, the songwriter and singer that Duncan is obsessing about. Here's her description of how the internet has changed everything for Duncan.
The internet came along and changed everything. When, a little later than everyone else, Duncan discovered how it all worked, he set up a website called Can Anybody Hear Me?, the title of a track from an obscure EP recorded after the wounding failure of Crowe's first album. Until then, the nearest fellow fan had lived in Manchester, 60 or 70 miles away, and Tucker met up with him once or twice a year. Now the nearest fans lived in Duncan's laptop, and there were hundreds of them from all around the world, and Duncan spoke to them all the time. There seemed to be a surprising amount to talk about. The website had a latest news section, which never failed to amuse Annie, Tucker no longer being a man who did an awful lot. As far as we know, Duncan always said. There was always something that passed for news among the faithful, though. A Crowe night on an internet radio station, a new article, a new album from a former band member, an interview with an engineer. The bulk of the content, though, consisted of essays, analysing lyrics or discussing influences or conjecturing, apparently inexhaustibly, about the silence. It wasn't as if Duncan didn't have other interests. He had a specialist knowledge of 1970s American independent cinema and the novels of Nathaniel West, and he was developing a nice new line in HBO television series. He thought he might be ready to teach The Wire in the not-too-distant future. But these were all flirtations by comparison. Tucker Crowe was his life partner. If Crowe were to die in real life, as it were, rather than creatively, Duncan would lead the mourning. He'd already written the obituary. Every now and again he'd worry out loud about whether he should show it to a reputable newspaper now or wait until it was needed.
That's Nick Hornby reading from his new novel, Juliet Naked. Why did you want to focus a novel around an artist who stopped recording and someone who's devoting much of his life to analyzing that musician's body of work and figuring out what elements are autobiographical, you know, having a website devoted to this artist, and then also the girlfriend of the guy who's obsessive about the singer-songwriter, and the book rotates between the points of view of each of these three characters. Why did you want to focus around the artist who could no longer make art and the people who are obsessing on him?
Well, I think this book started with an article I read in a magazine 3 or 4 years ago about Sly Stone, in fact, who at the time was a recluse, and the journalist had managed to fix up an interview with him, and eventually he turned up for it. And there was such a sort of narrative thrill in that, somebody appearing after a long absence and a fan's excitement meeting this person, that I something about it stuck in my mind, and a lot of the other ideas in the book accumulated around that. There was also something about those guys' relationships with, you know, the Dylans and the Springsteens, the people who lecture on those people, and that idea of Annie meeting Tucker and possibly there being some kind of flirtation involved. I like the idea of what Duncan would think about that. I mean, half of those Dylan guys, if Dylan met their wives on the road, those guys would want their wives to sleep with Bob Dylan rather than not, if you see what I mean.
Because, it would make them more valuable.
Well, more valuable, and also the information that you would get out of somebody.
True.
So there was something about that that appealed to me too. But I wanted to write about art and writing, I suppose, and how music is received and talked about, and how when an artist has made something, how it's not theirs anymore. All of these kinds of things. That this seemed like a good peg for it all.
Are these characters all different sides of you? Because you're both an artist and a fan.
Well, I'd say that's where the book comes from, that I'm an artist and a fan. That's not the same, I think, as saying that the characters are me. I think that the moment you get characters to do things in fiction, the moment they start to live lives, then it takes them away from you. But clearly, I suppose the ideas in the book are from me, even if there's no biographical detail that's taken from my life in there.
You describe the relationship between Annie and Duncan in the book, the couple. And just to clarify, the guy in the couple is the guy who's obsessed with the singer-songwriter.
Yes.
And so you say they were stuck in a perpetual postgraduate world where gigs and books and films mattered more to them than they did to other people of their age. Do you see anything wrong with that?
No, I absolutely don't. And
good. I wasn't sure if that was a complaint or not, but I thought, what's wrong with that?
It's absolutely not a complaint. I mean, it's really a complaint about everybody else. I think we all know that as we get older, it's more of a struggle to keep in touch with those things. And the things that usually stop us from keeping in touch is children. And Duncan and Annie don't have any.
Children play a very interesting role in the book. You know, the couple in the book doesn't have children, and mm-hmm. and she's at the point where she's decided she really wants children and wondering if it's become too late for her. And at the same time, the musician, Tucker Crowe, he has children by women he barely remembers. He's having a grandchild through a daughter he's never met. But he's now raising a six-year-old who's the center of his life. And so for all the people in the novel, having a child or not having a child is nothing the way it once was. Like, there's a whole new calculus now.
Yes. Well, first of all, families are a lot more complicated, I think, for more or less everybody.
Absolutely.
And Tucker's an exaggerated version of that. He has, five children by four mums and dysfunctional relationships with all of them except his youngest. Meanwhile, Annie, constantly fantasizes about having a child and feels that she's left it too late. She's been in the wrong relationship for too long. Partly I wanted to dramatize that thing that probably all parents know, which is that you are not human if you don't spend a moment in your life fantasizing about having no children. And people without children, of course, spend parts of each day fantasizing about life with children. And there are these two parallel universes, and each looks equally attractive to the other.
Has having a son changed your relationship to music and books and movies? You probably have less time, but how has it changed your relationship to that?
Well, I have three sons.
You have three sons, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Now I've got my 16-year-old and I have two little ones, a 6 and a 5-year-old. The little ones in particular, yes, have changed my relationship with things. We are now devoted watchers of a program called X Factor, which I don't know if you have here, but is basically the same as American Idol. And I completely see the point of this program now in a way that I didn't a year or two ago. And it's interesting things like that. They pick up on music. They listen to a lot of music. I watch movies with them. We go and see all the animated movies. In some ways, I'm less in touch with the things that used to mean a lot to me, and more in touch with things that didn't. But I still have very much a relationship with contemporary popular culture through them.
So give us an example, I guess maybe you just did, of stuff that you're watching or listening to that would not have meant anything if you didn't have children.
Well, I was going to say as we speak, but not quite. But certainly the last 2 weeks have been completely dominated by a band called the Plain White Tees, who my little boys discovered through a program called iCarly, which I also didn't know about before. And we've had to buy Plain White Tees albums because they made an appearance in the iCarly show. And it's not music that means an awful lot to me, but it's pretty unobjectionable, and it's not a million miles away from things that I like. So, you know, it's a common ground that we have.
Do you ever despair that your children like things that you think aren't good?
Actually, they do. They like pretty good things most of the time. But no, I don't despair about that at all. I think that I would despair if they didn't like things. And I think as I've got older, I've come to realize that the most important thing is that we have emotional connections to music or movies or books, and it doesn't matter what those things are.
May I ask, I know one of your sons is autistic. How old is
yeah.
he? How old is he?
He's 16.
Yeah, so has he developed an ear or an eye for music or film or books, the kinds of things that you're so passionate about?
Well, no, not books. He doesn't read. Movies he quite enjoys. When we take him to see a movie, he won't often stick it out all the way through. He's very honest in a way that adults and indeed other kids aren't. He'll reach a point and just stand up and walk, and you have to follow behind. He can't be persuaded to watch the rest of the movie if he's decided he's had enough. Music is an important part of his life. He just asks for music, and it's difficult to tell. He's quite severely autistic, so it's difficult to tell what he's responding to, and he doesn't ask for anything by name, but he needs it on journeys, and he has his own iPod and things like that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nick Hornby, who's famous for his novel High Fidelity. He wrote the screenplay for a movie that's about to open called An Education, and he also has a new novel, which is called Juliet Naked. And it's about a singer-songwriter who hasn't recorded or performed since 1986. And it's also about the guy who runs the website that obsesses on the singer-songwriter's work and absence, and the website guy's girlfriend who isn't obsessed with this singer-songwriter until she reviews his work, he responds to it, and then they end up emailing and actually meeting. So it's an unusual triangle.
It's not good for a one-line pitch, this book, I'm beginning to realize.
No. Do you want to give it a shot?
No. You did better than I could.
Annie dislikes the way that her boyfriend Duncan listens to music. Because he writes about it. He considers himself a pop culture scholar. And she thinks that he uses his scholarship sometimes as to bully her. She says, listening to music was something that she did, frequently with great enjoyment, and Duncan somehow managed to spoil it, partly by making her feel that she was not good at it. Talk about that line, that feeling that somebody is making you feel like you're not good at listening to music.
Well, I agree with you that when you use the word scholar about Duncan, I kind of conceived him as a scholar, that if his obsession had been with Mahler or Gerard Manley Hopkins, he would have been gainfully employed in a university somewhere. But because it's somebody that very few people have heard of, then, of course, he has to do another job. But I think scholars can be particular bullies, in fact, and they're quite often the people who are telling you that you're reading something the wrong way, listening to something the wrong way. Of all people who are not so keen on a plurality of response, I would say it's the world expert in something.
Do you feel like you've been guilty of that yourself ever?
I think anybody who cares deeply about music or movies or books goes through a period where they can become intensely irritated by a lukewarm response or even a negative response to something. And it's been a long process for me, I think, the idea that people respond in their own way to things. And partly that's come through writing.
And maybe through having children.
Maybe through having children as well, yes. I mean, the children have been good in that way, that you can see that something brings them joy and pleasure, and it might not be what you choose, but why on earth be snooty about it and try and lead them away from the thing they're enjoying to something that they would enjoy less, which seems to me the job of a critic quite a lot of the time.
In your new novel, Juliet Naked, you write a little about sexual relationships or about people wanting or not wanting sex. It's not explicit in any way, but I guess the point I'm getting to is that one of the characters in this, this singer-songwriter who hasn't recorded or performed in many years, he's in his late 50s, and sex for him is different. He's older. He's had a medical problem. I don't want to go into too much. But anyway, so you've had to deal with what a sexual relationship would mean for him at his stage in life, which is really different than the younger characters that you're famous for creating. And so I'm not sure what my question is exactly. But
how's my sex life? Now I'm getting
No, that's not the question. But the question yes. but the question is more about like writing characters, writing about a character's sexual life and sexual desires or lack of desire who is older.
Well, it would be very hard for me to write High Fidelity now, I think. I'm proud of the book, but it was a younger man's book. And I think turning 50 was quite a big thing for me. I think it was the first time I actually did realize that I was going to get old and die.
Did that change your life, that sense that you are going to get old and die?
Not as much as it not as much as it should have done, I don't think. But you know, when you turn 20 or 30 or 40, you go around making all the same jokes about, oh my God, I can't believe I'm so old. But when you're 50, you don't say it anymore because you just are old. So it's not so funny anymore. And there is a lot about mortality and regret, I think, in this book. Tucker's 6-year-old son has a real problem with the idea of mortality. And that was lifted out of my own 6-year-old and a stage he went through, which was pretty interesting and quite distressing, actually.
A fear that you would die because you're older than the other parents, that you would die before he was grown up.
I don't think he was too worried about that, even. And I was 45, I guess, when he was born, so it was, you know, it wasn't like I broke the world record or anything. No, it was more him dying, everybody dying. It was just clocking that it was going to happen. And what I found hilarious in retrospect was how quickly I resorted to Orthodox religion as consolation. Even though I'm atheistic in my own beliefs, and up until that point, I'd always told him that, you know, there wouldn't be much talk about Jesus in our house because we didn't really believe in it. And then the moment he said, you're going to die, and Mum's going to die, and I'm going to die, and everybody's going to die, I said, yeah, but it's okay, because you'll see us all in heaven.
How do you feel about that, about telling him stuff that you don't believe in? Is it more like telling him about Santa Claus, or are you going to start actually telling him more about it and starting to believe it too?
I think as one gets older, one realizes the value of pragmatism with children. And obviously I'm telling him something I don't believe, but very soon he will be able to work out that belief for himself. And I think you cannot go around confronting children with the brutal truth at every stage of their lives. At the moment, my 6-year-old's convinced he'll play for Arsenal, which is our local football team, and he won't. He won't be good enough, but I don't really see the value of telling him that he's never going to play for Arsenal. He'll work it out for himself, just as he'll work out what happens to us all after he dies.
I want you to just kind of set up what the story is about in an education, because I let you give away as much as you're comfortable giving away in that description, so that we could talk a little bit about the movie.
Well, it's a movie about a 16-year-old girl who turns 17 during the course of the film, called Jenny, and her relationship with an inappropriate and slightly dodgy older man in London right at the beginning of the 1960s.
The screenplay is based on a memoir by a woman, Lynn Barber, who's a journalist in England who I gather writes a lot of celebrity profiles and things like that.
Yeah, she, I guess she's quite famous for turning on people. she's written the odd, quite sort of notorious profile of celebrities. When she doesn't like them, she lets you know that she doesn't like them. But she's a very good writer and an interesting person. And this memoir, when I first read it, was originally, it was a 10-page piece in the literary magazine Granta. It just dealt with this one episode in her life, and she's since turned that into a book. I'm not the episode, but she's written a memoir that incorporates other things. So I read it, I guess, about 5 years ago, and I showed it to my wife. I said, I think you should do something with this. There's a lot in here. And that's how it started.
So one of the things I really like about the movie is that it's about a really smart high school girl who really wants to live the life of the mind. But she lives in this working class neighborhood. She has no access to the kind of life that she dreams about. You know, she listens to her Juliet Greco records and imagines what life in Paris would be like, and she's learning to speak French. But, you know, her life is actually pretty drab, and her goal is to go to Oxford. But when she meets this older man who we don't know much about, he can offer her what seems to be this really glamorous life of, like, nightclubs and art auctions, and it's so seductive. And it's so risky because it's taking her away from what she needs to develop a life of the mind. And who knows who he really is. And I found it really interesting that you were so passionate about this story that you wanted to adapt it into a film. You're so well known for writing mostly about a certain male point of view. Why did you want to write from this female point of view and from the dangers that a woman in high school faces?
Well, I guess, first of all, I feel that I accept that I'm famous for writing about certain kind of man, but the last few books, I think, have moved away from that a little bit. When I read the piece, I identified with her completely. I felt the same. I grew up in a similar, I guess, suburb to hers, and I felt that I was going to be crushed by the lack of culture around me. It wasn't that, you know, it was a difficult upbringing in any way. I don't think Lynn's upbringing was difficult, but she was scared that she wasn't going to get access to the things that she wanted. So I started to think of it really as a female equivalent of my first book, Fever Pitch, which was a memoir about soccer, but where soccer seemed to provide some kind of direct route into the life of the city. So there was that attracted me to it immediately. And then the more I started to think about it, the more I liked other things in it. I loved it tonally. I thought it was painful and funny at the same time. And most things just kind of go into a groove and stay there. They're either funny or they're not funny. And I love things that make you laugh and cry, and that material doesn't come around very often. And I guess the third thing was Britain in 1962. So during the events of this film, the Beatles and the Stones were more or less literally in recording studios, but nobody had heard a note. So the country was going to change pretty soon, but they weren't aware of that. There's a country right on the verge of change. And I think it probably has more in common with 1945 than it does with 1963. that character would have lived with food rationing for the first half of her life, for example.
Yeah, in writing about British teenagers in the early 60s when the movie is set, you write, London at the time, at the beginning of the 60s, still bore more than a passing resemblance to its wartime self. It is strange to think, for example, that Jenny would have experienced the privations of food rationing for the first half of her life. This was one reason why the UK needed interpreters of American music, like Lennon and McCartney, people to transform it so that it made sense. What didn't make sense about American music to British kids growing up after the war?
Well, I think if you look at 50s American rock and roll, it was a product of affluence to a certain extent. You think about, you know, big cars and driving your girlfriend around, and that's what a lot of the songs were about. Well, that just didn't happen in England. Nobody had cars. You waited for buses in bad weather normally. And we were completely ruined by World War II, and America was made in some ways by World War II. And it took a while for us to be able to recognize something in the music, I think, that made some kind of sense. When I was thinking about music for this movie, I was looking on my iPod and realized that I don't have one song that was made in England before 1960. I have a great deal of American music made before 1960, but no English music at all. And then suddenly that changed with what happened, obviously. And I think that's revealing of something.
I want to end with a question that's based on your new novel, Juliet Naked. There's two quotes about art that are such great contrast to each other, and I really think sum up so well what it's like when you're immersed in music or literature or film. Okay, so here's a quote about what it's like to be at a bad concert. Mediocre loud music penned you into yourself, made you pace up and down your own mind until you were pretty sure you could see how you might end up going out of it. And then here's a quote about great art. One thing about great art, it made you love people more, forgive them their petty transgressions. It worked in the way that religion was supposed to. I love that contrast because, you know, great art, it is almost like religion. I mean, it has this kind of larger resonance that makes you glad you're alive and see things in a different way. And but bad art, again, especially when you're trapped in a theater or in a concert where it's taking place and you can't really leave, it can just make you just think about thoughts and obsess on bad things and make you really wish you could get out of there. And
yeah, I think bad concerts and massages for me come to the same thing.
Massages?
Yeah, I hate massages for exactly the same reason. There's no escape. You're stuck with your own. but yes, the great art thing. I guess that's the position I've arrived at finally. Is that anything that makes you feel more alive is good for you, and if that happens to be the Da Vinci Code or the Backstreet Boys, well, you know, good luck to you. But if you feel more alert and more able to cope and more willing to communicate as a result of anything you might consume, then that thing is performing a valuable function in your life, I think.
It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Lovely to talk to you again, Terry.
Nick Hornby's new novel is called Juliet Naked. He wrote the screenplay for the new film An Education, which opens October 9th. Here's Peter Sarsgaard and Carey Mulligan in a scene from the film.
I suppose you have homework to do.
You have no idea how boring everything was before I met you. Action is character, our English teacher says. I think it means that if we never did anything, we wouldn't be anybody. And I never did anything before I met you.
Many of modern society's strategies for nurturing children are backfiring because new research in the science of children has been overlooked. That's the premise of the new book, Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children, by Ashley Merriman and my guest, Poe Bronson. An article they wrote about parenting for New York Magazine won an award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Poe Bronson is also the author of the bestseller, What Should I Do With My Life? Poe Bronson, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, in terms of talking about why modern parenting has failed to produce a generation of angels. You say that, you know, parents today know they're not supposed to fight in front of the children. And you say there are unintended consequences of taking marital arguments upstairs, you know, in an attempt to shelter your children from a fight. What are the unintended consequences of that?
Mark Cummings' lab out of the University of Notre Dame is looking at this very phenomenon very closely, and he has parents simulate arguments in front of their kids, or he has kids watch videotapes of arguments, and he has parents as conspirators in his experiments. And normally when a kid watches a fight between parents, an argument, quite heated conflict, that kid will then lash out afterwards or during it and act aggressive. But there's one thing that happens in those experiments that makes all that aggressive behavior in the child go away. It's watching the fight get resolved. It's watching your parents work it out in a constructive way. And when I read this, I understood that taking it upstairs, you know, I might have a moment of conflict with my wife, and I'll say that according to Cummings' data, you know, parents are bickering to each other 7 to 8 times a day. And the kids are witness to it. It's wrong to imagine the kids aren't seeing this and feeling it. But when we take the arguments upstairs, the kid sees the fight begin but never sees it amicably resolved. And that's hurting kids more. And in fact, Cummings' work is now showing, just most recent data, that kids who are exposed to constructive conflict, and it can be quite heated, but when it's resolved and worked out in front of the kids, those kids are being reported by teachers as having better well-being and better social skills and sort of more adaptive in their environment at school. Parents need to model for kids how to work through arguments, how to work it out.
So are you suggesting parents fight in front of the kids and then hopefully they'll reach an end of the argument, have an amicable resolution, and the kid will learn from that?
Mark Cummings would never say, hey, go out and fight in front of your kids. It's a really good thing to do. He would say that more that don't pretend your kid isn't seeing some of your conflict. Parents believe they're sort of hiding their kids from this conflict, but the kids can feel it. And so the important thing is to be aware when you did start something in front of your kids to then really try to model for the benefit of the kids working it out. And that might mean holding your tongue and enthusiastically trying to compromise in front of the kids so they can see from their parents how to do this with their own friendships.
In your book, Nurture Shock, you cite a really interesting study that compared, progressive dads, traditional dads, and disengaged dads in their styles of parenting. What is meant by progressive dads?
Well, these are the modern fathers who are co-parenting, who can change a diaper one-handed and pop up the porta crib in 30 seconds and know how to, you know, feed the baby and put the baby to bed and are very actively involved in their children's lives.
And a problem that emerged in the study is that the fathers who came under this category of progressive dad were having trouble, some of them anyways, were having trouble disciplining their children. They didn't want to hit their children or scream at them, of course, but they weren't sure what to do instead. What was the discomfort that they had with the idea of disciplining their children?
Progressive dads, they imagine this wonderful, you know, tight bond with their kids, and they haven't really thought about the fact that disciplining their kid is going to be part of the job. And they don't necessarily – they know how to be great to their kid and nice to their kid, but they don't necessarily have a strategy for disciplining. And as a result, they experiment as discipliners. One day they'll say, well, you know, no dessert. And the next day they'll act really mean to their kid or angry or offended trying to show the kid what they've done is wrong. And then the next day they'll withdraw some other privilege or say you have to go to bed early. And it becomes very inconsistent. And the science of disciplining your kid says that the one mistake to make is to be inconsistent. Any form of consistent discipline is better than inconsistent discipline where you're losing your cool and you're confused. And as a result, the children of progressive dads, you know, when they were rated by teachers and others at their schools, were acting out and being just as aggressive as the children of disengaged dads.
So did that surprise you?
Yeah, because I'm a progressive dad, for sure. And I saw myself in that data. I saw myself in Dr. Shope Sullivan's data that most of my childhood or most of my kids' childhood, I wasn't really sure what to do about when problems came along and how to react to them. And I saw it and I learned to just calm down and make sure I'm being consistent and talk calmly to them and not lose my cool or lose my temper or not be offended when my kid, you know, does something wrong.
So as somebody who considers himself a progressive dad, were you having trouble being the disciplinarian with your children?
Yes, for my son and my daughter, it was I, like many of the progressive dads, experience almost a sense of embarrassment that I'm in this situation, that I have to discipline my kid. Because I would have thought, you know, that when, as this modern parent doing all these supposedly good things for my kid, that they wouldn't be acting out at school, they wouldn't be causing problems, they wouldn't have joined in the teasing of that boy, they wouldn't have pushed that girl.
And they would have just, like, learned from your example as a good person.
Yeah, because, you know, we're such lovely parents. And the way that I dealt with this, I realize I had been inconsistent. And seeing that portrait has really helped me sort of just calm down about this and be more consistent and especially not act offended and not lose my cool.
Let's move on to the issue of sleep, which you also write about in your book, Nurture Shock. And there's been some interesting studies on how sleep functions differently in children than in adults, and the consequences of not having enough sleep are different for children than adults. Let's start with the fact that one study shows that children are sleeping an hour less than they did 30 years ago. How is that measured? How do they know that?
It's not a single study. That would be an aggregation of dozens of studies, work from the National Sleep Foundation, amongst many other scholars, have been looking at this. And when you look at the whole picture, you see a disturbing trend, which is that we all remember not getting a lot of sleep, certainly when we were in high school. In the last 30 years, we've subtracted another hour from that. So imagine what you used to get and how sleepy you were, and then subtract an hour, and that's what today's kids are doing. The average high schooler is sleeping 6.65 hours per night. And the science is interesting here because it says that sleep scientists will tell you should be sleeping without an alarm clock. You should be sleeping, you know, 9-10 hours a night. Okay, I think that's not really – people aren't going to do that. But if you subtract the first hour, which is what we did when we were kids, you don't see a whole lot of impairment. But when you subtract the second hour, which is what we've done in the last 30 years, you see a huge steep fall off. And you see a dramatic sort of impairment of cognitive abilities, and you see this slushing over into other dimensions of children's lives.
Are children sleeping less because school is starting earlier?
Many school districts, to save money, have gotten rid of the two fleets of buses. The old fleet, one fleet would take kids to elementary school and the other fleet would take kids to the high schools. And by having a single fleet and starting high schools very early, 7:30, 7:15, 7:50 in the morning, those buses could then turn around, pick up the other set of kids in the elementary school and let them start at 8:30 or 9. And so, yes, high schools are starting earlier and earlier around the country, and it's had a dramatic effect. A few districts, intrepid districts, looking at the science of sleep, have they've been willing to bite the bullet and trust the science, which I recognize isn't necessarily easy, and move their school start times back an hour. One of these districts in Minnesota did that, and they saw the SAT scores for the best and the brightest in the district leap by over 200 points.
Tell us some of the things that researchers have learned about the importance of sleep in children when they're learning.
Adults spend only 4% of the night in what's called slow-wave sleep. Kids spend 40% of their slumber in slow-wave sleep. We've always heard this idea that there's these different stages of sleep, you know, REM sleep, non-REM sleep, slow-wave. We're really sure what those were for. Well, it turns out that these different phases of sleep are being used by the brain to take short-term memories and re-encode them as long-term memories to be recalled later. And different forms of memories are being re-encoded in the different stages of sleep. And it's in, you know, children are especially vulnerable to sleep loss because it's cutting way down on their slow wave sleep when a lot of cognitive stuff is being encoded in their brain. And the result is that the sleepy kid not only is sort of tired and therefore perseverates and can't maintain attention, but that their brain literally didn't get done encoding things.
Are there other cognitive issues that have come out of sleep research?
You know, the surprise, Terry, is not that sleep matters. It's how much it matters and how little bits of difference can matter as well. You know, Karskadon's data out of Rhode Island and Wallstrom's data out of Minnesota shows that, I'll broadly characterize it here, that A students average 15 more minutes sleep than B students, who average 15 more minutes sleep than C students, and so on. Every 15 minutes can count. And Dr. Ave Sade out of Tel Aviv University did some work where he had sixth graders and fourth graders get a little more sleep, half hour more sleep than they usually get, or half hour less than they usually get for 3 nights. And then he gave them intelligence tests. And the sleepy sixth graders were testing out like the fourth graders, that a loss of even 3 nights of sleep for a half hour each night was equal to the difference between a sort of a fourth grader and a sixth grader on these sort of subcomponent IQ tests. And again, there, the idea was every half hour counts. And we treat our children's sleep, I call it the slush hour before they go to bed. We sort of treat it like the national debt. You know, what's another 15 minutes on the bill? But we wanted to argue that when every 15 minutes counts, you know, maybe parents would now begin to pay attention to what's going on in that slush hour of their children's lives.
So what are the recommendations that have come out of this, in addition to the recommendation that schools should consider starting a little later, not starting at 7:15 or 7:30?
It seems so easy to say, oh, well, let's go to bed earlier. I mean, science has been arguing that forever, and people have been hearing that forever, and we're not listening to it. I hope people understand that every 15 minutes counts. They might begin to trust some of the science and inch it back a little bit. In some ways, this is one of those reductionist things. If the broad advice is of all this incredible science is this puny little advice point, go to bed earlier, it almost doesn't just do justice to how interesting the science is.
And it's just easier said than done, too.
It's certainly easier said for done. I mean, what we are fighting against is this notion in our society that resisting sleep is a character strength. Sleep is for wusses. And, you know, sleep when you're dead. And it's these mentalities that, you know, parents are filling their kids' lives with so many activities, and then the kids are bringing in all this technology and social networking, and unwittingly, we haven't really known the true cost of the sleep. And as their parents, we could say, yeah, I'm sleepy, but I'm surviving. What's important to note is that what's going on in your brain is an adult brain. What's going on in your kid's brain is quite different.
Well, Paul Bronson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I really appreciate it.
Paul Bronson is the co-author of the new book, Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Henry Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Hevar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. We'll close with a song from Roseanne Cash's new CD, The List, that will be released next week. It's a collection of songs from the list her father, Johnny Cash, put together of 100 essential songs she needed to know. Roseanne Cash will be our guest on Monday. I'm Terry Gross.
I've got your picture that you gave to me, and it's signed with love, just like it used to be. She's got you. I've got the right.